From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. First this hour, General Motors is seeking billions of dollars from the federal government to stay afloat. GM needs money to pay for a possible merger with Chrysler.
In a moment, we'll hear from someone who says it's time to let American car companies fail. First, to what GM says, NPR's Frank Langfitt gets us started.
GM officials have been making the rounds in Washington. The company is tearing through cash and looking for a lifeline. Greg Barton is a company spokesman.
We have for quite some time now been talking to a variety of officials, just as other companies and industries have been doing during these very difficult times. We believe government should employ all the tools that's available to it to support an industry that's in distress and is important to the economy.
One tool GM is looking at is the Treasury Department's $700 billion bailout fund. The money was originally designed to buy toxic mortgage-backed securities. Now it's being used to pump money into banks. Treasury spokeswoman Brooklyn McLaughlin described the kind of firms that qualify.
The capital purchase program is available to federally regulated banks and savings institutions.
Okay, that does not sound like General Motors, but GM does have a loan financing arm, GMAC. And Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson has proved creative as the credit crisis has spread to a variety of industries. Another place GM is looking for money is the Department of Energy. The agency has $25 billion set aside for the auto industry. But that money is designed to promote fuel-efficient vehicles, not mergers. Haley Baumgartner, a spokeswoman for the agency, would not confirm any conversations with GM, but she added this from a statement.
The Department of Energy has always had an open line of communication with the automakers, an industry we highly support, as part of our Advanced Vehicle Technology Program, among others.
Baumgartner said the agency is still writing the rules for the loan program. She also said it hasn't received formal applications yet. Whether General Motors can get any of this money, there's no question it needs it.
GM is currently burning through cash at about $1 billion a month.
That's Aaron Bragman. He's an auto analyst with Global Insight, the financial analysis firm. The credit crisis and an apparent recession have destroyed consumer demand for cars. Bragman says GM needs cash just to survive.
Sales are down such to the point where they're just basically not making any money and they're really losing their shirt in the market. So they have to try and find new sources and more people that'll lend them money.
That's one reason GM is eyeing Chrysler. The smallest of the Detroit three has lots of problems, but as of a few months ago, it also had $11 billion on hand. The other reason GM wants Chrysler is some valuable brands, including Jeep and the Dodge minivan. But Aaron Bragman acknowledges that combining the firms won't be easy.
It's basically taking two sick companies and putting them together and trying to make one healthy company out of it. And that's not going to happen without a lot of cutting and a lot of slashing and a lot of burning.
GM would have to get rid of many competing Chrysler brands. It would also have to lay off many thousands of workers. Bragman says the company would probably use some federal money to pay severance to United Auto Worker members to avoid a strike.
Do you have any reason to believe that a merger would work?
That's a very good question. There are far more obstacles, frankly, in terms of making this merger work than there are chances of success.
Indeed, recent history is not encouraging. An earlier union between Chrysler and the German firm Daimler was a disaster. Marianne Keller, a longtime auto analyst, says mergers often don't work out as planned.
All kinds of things that are, you know, in the realm of the unexpected, torpedo your very best assumption.
But in the current crisis, General Motors faces dwindling options. As Aaron Bragman put it, the big question may not be what happens if GM merges with Chrysler, but what will happen if it doesn't. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
There are people who oppose a GM bailout and who say let Detroit fail. One of them is Peter Morici, an economist who teaches at the University of Maryland School of Business. Professor Morici, why not come to the aid of a car maker that employs tens of thousands of people, and some would say much more than that in related companies?
Well, General Motors doesn't have a clean turnaround plan. When we helped out Lee Iacocca's Chrysler, Iacocca had a plan to make the company competitive again, and he succeeded. Rick Wagner, who leads General Motors at this time, has had several plans to turn around GM, and they've all failed. Essentially, General Motors brings product to market too slowly at too high a cost, and its production costs are too high. A bailout doesn't solve the problem unless the taxpayer wants to get in the business of sending cash to General Motors every year to subsidize its payroll.
If, in fact, the federal government had expected that much of the banks Would they be investing money right now? There seem to be a lot of banks that are improvising and don't have a clear plan for what they're going to do.
The bailout of the banks was necessary, but the Treasury demanded too little of the banks, and I expect that within a few years, several of them will be in trouble again. If we're going to assist banks, car companies, or whatever, because they're large employers or they're vital to the economy, they have to have good plans to make themselves permanently vital so that they can continue to contribute to the economy without additional aid.
But at this point, GM is in a different situation from, say, Chrysler back in 1979, in that Chrysler didn't face the global credit crisis that GM does right now. What alternative does GM have? You can't very well say, well, go to the credit markets and get some money to tide you over. Nobody's lending.
Even if we did not have a global credit crisis, I doubt that the General Motors would be able to borrow much more money. General Motors has had one turnaround plan after another over the last 10 years. None of them have achieved results. It's been in a constant downsizing mode. And it's getting to the point where no one really expects all three of the Detroit automakers to be around long term. The question is which one fails. That shouldn't be the one that doesn't get a federal check.
Should it be a condition or a de facto condition of support for GM that Mr. Wagoner should go?
I don't know that that should be a de facto condition. I think that the condition should be that General Motors bring forward a plan to bring its labor costs in line with the Japanese automakers making cars right here in the United States, and that it demonstrate that it can use that aid to bring to market a reasonable portfolio of products to address the nation's energy conservation needs, so that going forward, it will be able to sustain its market share.
But in a way, you're asking the federal government to do something that might be a little bit above their pay grade, which is to figure out whether GM has a good enough line of cars that could roll out in a couple of years to make it more competitive in the domestic car market.
Well, it wasn't above the federal government's pay grade to make an evaluation with regard to Chrysler. That was a very successful program. In the end, the federal government made some money because it got warrants, which became common shares, and it sold, and it got paid back all the money it was owed. My feeling is it's up to General Motors to define a plan that is viable. The federal government alone doesn't have to assess that. There are plenty of folks outside the car industry that are keeping a close eye on General Motors that could provide some indication of whether it makes sense.
Just one last point, though. Have you found yourself at all taken by the example of Lehman Brothers, which was not bailed out, and everybody thought at the time that that was a great stand in favor of moral hazard? In the days since, people have thought perhaps that was the wrong move. Perhaps we unplugged the entire world financial market by being erratic as to who got helped and who didn't.
I don't know that we necessarily made a mistake with Lehman Brothers, or that what followed would not have followed in any case. If it wasn't Lehman Brothers, it would have been someone else. Our banks are fundamentally unviable the way they are. They have a lot of bad paper on their books, and it's not just a subprime problem. They have many, many problems. My feeling is that sooner or later, Lehman Brothers would have come apart given the quality of management that it had. But moreover, we can't use the Lehman Brothers events as an excuse to subsidize every company or every large company that finds itself in trouble, or we're literally going to be in a situation where people are free to make profits if they're smart, and the government's going to pick up their losses if they're not. That makes no sense for running a market economy.
Professor Morisi, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're quite welcome.
That's Peter Morisi of the University of Maryland School of Business. And now we'd like to know what you think. Should the government bail out the auto industry? There will be a live debate on NPR.org tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Get your comments and questions ready.
A vote is scheduled for Saturday for the 27,000 members of the Machinists Union at Boeing. Yesterday, the aerospace company and the union reached a tentative agreement that would end a long strike. As NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports from Seattle, the union is expected to approve the deal.
The strike has lasted more than 7 weeks, and it's been costly for both workers and the company. Without its machinists, Boeing factories have been shut down. Union members have an average base wage of about $55,000 a year, and while Boeing called its final offer before the strike an outstanding one, union members wanted higher pay, higher pensions, and job security. Did they get it? The union claims victory, pointing to economic gains, including a 15% wage increase over 4 years, an $8,000 bonus, and no health care cost increases. On the extremely contentious issues of job security and outsourcing, both the union and management say they got what they needed. The union preserved more than 2,000 jobs delivering parts to the factory floor and got additional retraining language, but Boeing retained flexibility in where most work is done and by whom. Here's company spokesman Tim Healy.
This is an agreement that gives the IM the job security provisions that it wanted, but allows us the flexibility we need to run the business. It rewards employees for their contribution to our success, but it allows us to remain competitive and sustain that success. And importantly, it's a 4-year deal, and that's something we wanted, and we think that customers will be happy to hear that.
A 4-year contract rather than the usual 3 gives Boeing more stability and certainty. Assessing who won in any strike is difficult, but analyst Scott Hamilton of the Lehman Group in Seattle says, on balance, the union did quite well, though Hamilton says the union didn't get everything it wanted on the thorny issue of outsourcing.
I'm not sure that from a practical standpoint that giving job protection for 2,000 jobs is all that meaningful. It's very symbolic, but on the larger macro issue of outsourcing, Boeing didn't concede anything.
Assuming the tentative agreement is approved on Saturday, Boeing's labor relations team will turn its attention to its engineers and technical workers. That contract is also up for renewal, and bargaining will begin tomorrow. The negotiations are likely to be contentious. And Boeing has yet another, perhaps even bigger worry. Given the financial meltdown and weakness in the global economy, what will happen to its orders? Will they be postponed or canceled? No one knows the answer to that question. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
And throughout this financial crisis, one of the most complicated issues has been whether to modify mortgages for borrowers having trouble with payments. The failure of IndyMac Bank this summer has given federal regulators an opportunity to experiment with that. Since July, IndyMac has been run by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC. So far, it's managed to strike new deals with 3,500 homeowners to reduce their payments. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports on the benefits and complexities of keeping people in their homes.
Cynthia Hendricks and her family ended up near foreclosure, literally by accident. In 1997, Hendricks hurt her back in a car accident and had to quit her six-figure accounting job.
We had a really nice life. We went on really nice vacations and, all that changes pretty quickly when you lose your job.
In the decades since, Hendricks, her husband Tom, and their two children faced a litany of medical mishaps. Knee replacement, severe infections, a broken jaw, back surgery. They filed for personal bankruptcy and sold their nice coastal New Jersey home. With their new bad credit scores, they got a subprime loan on the small ranch house where they live now.
The goal was always within 2 years to improve our credit score, improve our credit rating, pay down some of these bills, and be able to get into a fixed rate mortgage at a decent interest rate. And that just never happened.
Originally, they'd hoped to tear down the house and rebuild a new one. But most of their $150,000 in annual income goes towards medical bills. So their home remains in serious disrepair. Drawers and cabinet doors are missing. The door to the garage is rotted. And the thermostat hangs from a hole in the wall.
We leave it like that because if you try and fix it, it doesn't work. Right.
Well, that's for years, they've gotten letters warning they face foreclosure.
Here I have one from IndyMac Bank from December of 2007. Your mortgage is in serious default because you have not made the required payments.
Then in August, they got another letter, this time in a Federal Express package. It offered to lower their interest rate by 3.5 percentage points, a move that would lower their payments from $4,300 a month to $2,600.
I felt like it was a gift from God. I was in shock. couldn't believe that they were going to actually reduce my interest rate, and it would remain that way. And it was like a lifesaver.
The Hendricks case is, as mortgage workouts go, a best-case scenario. For one thing, to qualify for IndyMac's program, you have to be more than 2 months behind on your mortgage payments. And the bank must have all your financial information, including proof of employment and income, in order to offer a deal. If you meet the criteria, you get a new offer. Cindy McGovern manages the IndyMac call center that handles the calls about mortgage workouts. Loan officers counsel people to cut cable TV or cancel their credit cards. Still, she says, many are too deep in the hole and are told, sorry, we can't help you.
It is definitely not a moral situation. It's definitely, you know, business driven. But those stories do tug, you know, at your heartstring.
When she first got the offer, Hendricks read it over and over again. It seemed too good to be real and far too generous to pass up.
It was just such a winning situation for everyone. No matter what I did, what I had to do, what I had to sell or beg, borrow or whatever, I was going to make that payment, you know, and I made that payment on September 15th.
Outside her house, Hendricks surveys the peeling paint and says she might be able to afford some repairs next spring. And for the first time in 10 years, she says she plans to start saving.
My next paycheck, I'll start putting money in my 401k again. My husband just increased his 401k. So now we'll be able to contribute to the economy, where if we were to go in foreclosure, you know, no one would benefit.
Hendricks says the last decade was full of humiliating experiences with creditors. She got through it on the hope, she says, that if she just tried her best to pay it off, maybe something good would happen. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.